is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome my good colleague, Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired colonel, artilleryman, CBS News Dickinson College visiting scholar, and Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy CEO. Budapest Tomahawks. In these last days, we've had changing directions. Right now, we're going to do both directions, thumbs up or thumbs down. Budapest. Jeff, a very good evening to you. I think it's postponed. I think it's called off. I think we haven't decided. All three possibilities. What was Budapest to be about? What was the mission before it was, well, one of the above? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening to you, John. Budapest was ostensibly about the same thing that the Alaska summit was about. And that was Mr. Trump trying to intervene very directly and bring to at least a ceasefire the war in Ukraine. And one might recall when he went to Anchorage, he said very categorically that if there was not an agreement by Putin for a ceasefire, that severe consequences would follow. And then he flip-flopped on that, and there have never been severe consequences. Ostensibly, Budapest was going to be basically a repeat. He was going to meet with Mr. Putin. That was going to be a bilat. That would be expanded perhaps to a trilateral involving President Zelensky of Ukraine, who had agreed to attend. But ostensibly now, Mr. Trump has figured out that there was no possibility of making any measured progress. Mr. Putin has reiterated his longstanding commitment to so-called root causes of the war have to be solved prior to any type of ceasefire. Those root causes include what? No Ukrainian entry into NATO, no Zelensky government. They have to be eliminated. An elimination of all military aid to Ukraine, a rollback of sanctions on Russia, a limitation to the Ukrainian military, an acknowledgement that Russian is the official language of Ukraine, along with the cessation of the Donbas region to Russia. In essence, what Mr. Putin has called for, and he has continued to say this, oh, by the way, he's been consistent, that when the Ukrainians surrender, he'll be willing to have a ceasefire and conduct a negotiation. And I think with the possibility of a repeat of what was, I thought, a rather embarrassing effort by the president in Alaska, Mr. Trump has, as you said, John, either postponed, will think about it, or it's not going to happen.
Tomahawks, thumbs up, thumbs down, still in the arsenal, as far as I know, in the U.S. Are they a game changer or just, as we understand, an escalation of firepower?
I would put it probably in an escalation of firepower, but again, I put it in the category of threats by Mr. Trump that he doesn't deliver on. And he's done this now three or four times. He's threatened either economic sanctions or some kind of expansion of aid to Ukraine, only to flip-flop once he's spoken to Mr. Putin on the phone. And of course, Zelensky arrived last Friday for a meeting that was touted to be when Trump would announce the delivery of Tomahawks to Ukraine. But on Thursday, Mr. Putin actually initiated this call. They had a call for 2 hours, and Mr. Trump flip-flopped again and said, no, no, we got to keep our Tomahawks, they're escalatory, et cetera, et cetera. But again, I don't find them to be a game changer so much, John, as something that would certainly escalate in terms of the kind of firepower available. Right now, the war seems to have settled into a fairly static front line. As we approach winter and the non-campaign season, more operationally or strategically, Russians are intensifying their efforts to strike Ukrainian cities and deprive the Ukrainians of energy and make the winter a very cold one in the Ukraine, very uncomfortable for the Ukrainian people, trying to break their willpower. In return, the Ukrainians are striking at Russian oil refineries and processing facilities and chemical factories. And the advent of the Tomahawk would allow them to do that at greater range. The Tomahawk having a range up to about 1,600 miles, very deep then into Russia, bring into play a large number of targets. But again, Mr. Trump has flip-flopped. And for right now, the delivery of any Tomahawks to Ukraine is on hold indefinitely.
Gaza, the vice president in the region shaking hands with the prime minister. The Gaza phase one still on because as of right now, and it keeps moving around, there are 13 deceased Israelis who have not been returned. The fighting inside Gaza is said to be between Hamas remnants and the clans who always were dominant, especially for drug running and cigarette smuggling into Gaza Strip. The fighting is going on daily. The Israelis have established a so-called yellow line, which I'm told is up to 50% of Gaza. There are reports of UK officers arriving in Israel to participate in, I guess, a multinational force monitoring the 50% or less of Gaza that remains in the hands of Hamas. Is this stable? Are we moving towards disarming in your measure?
No, John, we're not, because I've yet to see any kind of plan. I think we haven't even had discussions in any great detail on how Hamas would be disarmed. And I'm not quite certain those UK officers are going to be a large portion of that. They may be, not unlike the several hundred Americans who are there to oversee the coordination of aid. One of the most important things going on, of course, is the return of large-scale aid to the population of Gaza, some 2 million people, many of whom were on the verge of starvation. And we got to make sure that aid not only happens, but that aid is sustained over time because of the devastation of the Gaza Strip. Can we, in fact, care for those people for an indefinite future? So that has to happen. But the whole idea of negotiating with Hamas or its disarmament had always been the one red line that struck me, at least, John, was going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to get across. Hamas largely opposed to that. Obviously, they've now given up the main leverage they had, which were living hostages. And as a consequence, once they give over their weapons, they're basically at the mercy of the Israelis, though ostensibly they would be allowed either to get amnesty and or be allowed to leave the country. But it's unclear to me whether we've even begun to talk about how that would be affected, let alone begin actually disarming Hamas.
The concern is that the war continues in a rearming phase. Is that too cynical, Jeff?
At the moment, I wouldn't say in a rearming phase, but what we have to acknowledge is what we have and what we don't have. We have a ceasefire. This is the third ceasefire. All those ceasefires ostensibly were to release some hostages, and hopefully they would lead then to a period or a pause where negotiations could occur for a final settlement. It failed the first two times, and it's very precarious at this particular moment. That's what we got. Mr. Trump gave a very optimistic speech to the Knesset, and he talked about this now being the dawn of a new Middle East and the war was over. I think that's a bit of a stretch, and it remains to be seen whether or not that can be affected, beginning with that red line of convincing Hamas to disarm and figuring out a way whereby Hamas could be disarmed. Once that's affected, then you have the basis whereby a stability force can come into the area, which would largely be Arab, and that can then kick off the possibility of doing some kind of rebuilding in the Gaza Strip. But up until those things happen, we're in a ceasefire, a precarious ceasefire at best.
I'm told the Egyptians and the Turks are arming for something much larger than Hamas fighting. That suggests to me there's instability in the region. What does it tell you, Jeff?
Well, exactly. The Egyptians are very concerned about two things. One, they've got a major war going on to their south in Sudan. Don't forget that's going on. And number two, they're very concerned that if things aren't settled in the Gaza Strip, they could be the main recipient of up to 2 million refugees crossing the Egyptian border. And they hardly want that to happen either. On the Turkish side, they're concerned about that. But the Turks are primarily concerned about stability in Syria. And in particular, it's the Syrian Democratic Forces in the very eastern portion of the country, supported by the United States, but very opposed by the Turks, because obviously the SDF is largely Kurdish. And there have been discussions I've heard between the Turks and the government in Damascus that will perhaps allow the Turkish forces to strike the SDF, which again, the Turks consider to be their enemy.
Finally, I call on you to comment because you have experience in a very large building we call the Pentagon. The Defense Department's policy, according to the Washington Post, the new policy, blocks journalists from soliciting information the department is not authorized for release, even unclassified details, a major shift in press outreach from the organization. Sean Parnell, the chief spokesman for the Pentagon, said that 26 people from 18 outlets signed the original document, including the Federalist and the Epoch Times. The rest of the list is very familiar to me as emails every morning from what are considered to be MAGA-friendly journalists reporting. What does this leave for us to understand about press releases from the Pentagon? Are they untrustworthy? Do we need to interpret them? Is the Pentagon going to give us information because there's war fighting going on?
No, the Pentagon is going to try not to give us information. The Pentagon is going to endeavor, under the Hegseth regime at least, to be as opaque as it possibly can be. I mean, it's even reduced intelligence sharing with the Congress, for goodness sake. And now it's going to populate the building with those who are very, very strong supporters of the government and are willing just to pass on official press releases from the Secretary of Defense. And all the true journalists that have covered the Pentagon, many of whom are friends of yours and mine, and for years have done that, have now refused to sign these particular statements and therefore been forced to leave the building. And on top of that, even today, the defense secretary announced that the military officials, to include the chairman, the chiefs of service, the secretary of the services, cannot speak to Congress unless they have the very specific authorization from a centralized office that reports to him. So Mr. Hegseth is making every effort to isolate the Pentagon from the American people and the American community and the United States Congress and control information flows. This is for an organization that spends $1 trillion of U.S. taxpayer monies every single year. But Mr. Hegseth does not want the American people to have any information about how that occurs or what operations are being conducted with their sons and daughters unless he personally approves.
This is an organization made up of, I say the obvious, the sons and daughters of America, and they're not going to report on the sons and daughters' safety of America?
That's right, John. The only thing they're going to give them is official statements that Mr. Hegseth deems appropriate. And, of course, the other possibility, of course, was him sharing it directly, but his entire time as Secretary of Defense, some 6 or 7 months, he has conducted exactly 2 press conferences.
What is the explanation for this withdrawal from the public conversation? What happened? Is there a moment?
I think the moment was the great Signalgate controversy, where Mr. Hegseth himself participated in this multi-chat communications of efforts to begin to conduct an air campaign against Yemen. And you might recall that the editor of The Atlantic was inadvertently included in that particular chat. And on top of that, Mr. Hegseth released what I would call classified information, which was correspondence between him and the central commander of CENTCOM about details of exactly when an airstrike against Yemen was going to occur. He basically copied and pasted it into a signal transmission, which is an unclassified method of providing information. And he put highly classified information in that particular transmission. There is an inspector general investigation ostensibly of that particular effort, which I think will find him quite guilty of violating the norms for handling classified information. But so far, that's dragged out and not been released. And I think from that very unhappy experience for the Secretary of Defense, that has made him somewhat paranoid or fearful about his position and consequently led him to this effort to try to isolate the American people from its military in terms of media coverage.
We marched to the sound of gunfire. We're headed to the Caribbean. Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, Dickinson College visiting professor, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. I'm John Batchelor.